Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by the fascinating and super dynamic Mark Shaler, who's the owner at The Mighty Ape. He's a thinker, doer, creator, speaker, and author who helps companies grow sustainably by developing people, strategies, and brand while reducing impact. Business coach and design council associate, Mark has saved his clients in excess of £120 million. He's also a founding partner of the utterly superb Do Lectures and author of the equally superb book, Do Disrupt, Change the Status Quo or Become It, which is now in its second edition. Mark works for some of the biggest and smallest companies in the world. So, Mark, hi, and how are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. And I'm going to add Do Present as well, which is a book on presentation skills that very handily, Sean, came out during a pandemic when no one presented. So the worst timing in the world. But that's a cracking read as well.
Oh, very good. In that case, have a bit of that. We'll talk about that one in a while. I know at the moment you're in the epically sounding Mr. Bingo's studio in Exmouth Market. So, yeah, very nice indeed. Very good indeed.
Mr. Bingo is sat to my right now, looking remarkably cool. Suave, actually. I'd say suave, yes.
Suave, like sort of Jason King. I imagine a sort of velvet jacket. Go on then, Mark. I mean, just to start somewhere, because I mean, I've known you for a long time, and it's been absolutely sort of fascinating over the years, sort of catching up with you and seeing what's going on, etc. So just from the point of view of your ethos, we'll go through the usual stuff in a while about, you know, how you got to where you are now and if it was a sort of very direct road or a very windy path. But your ethos of helping big companies think small and small companies think big. Go on then, let's start there. Just perhaps just take us through that.
That's a great starting point, actually. And I twin that ethos with my second ethos of it's not sufficient to do things better, we need to do better things. And I spent a long time helping companies just slightly improve everything. And to slightly improve something isn't enough anymore. And so I now help them make kind of rather larger cultural dynamic shifts. And that twins with helping big companies think small, because most of my big clients are trapped in a business model from the past, they're trapped in a business model that they've inherited and that isn't really fit for the future. So I help them think their way through that and plan something a little differently by you know, and there's some cliches in here, but allowing them to kind of move a bit quicker, come up with ideas that are maybe a little more eccentric than they would normally come up to, by creating a safe place to play and getting small budgets behind them. Being almost like an internal incubator or an internal startup, really. So that's what I do. And then I help little companies who want to think big by you know, lifting their gaze away from the everyday into a more strategic place. And I still do the sustainability stuff.
Yeah. And which is the sort of more compelling area at the moment? I mean, is it literally both sort of 50-50, or are you finding that one of those areas, the big company or the small company angle, is the one that's really the most sort of scintillating at the moment?
It's really interesting. It's a great question, Sean. And I'm going to split the answer into pre-pandemic and post-pandemic. Pre-pandemic, my world had shifted almost entirely into helping larger companies come up with smaller ideas. And I did maybe 20% of my work on sustainability, on doing things better and doing better things. As a result of, I think, people spending some time looking at their business, as a result of the climate emergency, which we've now found a language to explore. That is a really key breakthrough there. This is about language and about understanding. And since we've been able to enunciate that and place some meaning into the words, everyone's got excited. So since then, most of my work is on sustainability. And it has been that dramatic a shift. Pre-pandemic, 80% around innovation or change. Post-pandemic, or we're still in the pandemic, aren't we? 80% around sustainability, zero carbon, and moving towards, you know, actually for me, moving back to what I started doing 32 years ago.
Well, so in that case, let's go back there to exactly where you started, and how and why you got to that point. Then it has to be said, a very, very long time before everyone else effectively caught up with your thinking. I think many people have that viewpoint. How come it was that you got into this so early, and perhaps just take us through your career path and just how you've seen other people as they realize that you were, has to be said, were sort of right all along, were certainly on the right path all along.
there is a bit of that. There is almost a I told you so feel sometimes. To what I say and do. I love geography, Sean. I absolutely love geography, whether that be the way people move, human geography, the way that goods move, the interface between human and physical geography, and the way that tectonics and clouds move, which is physical geography. I love all of those three areas. I love physics and I love English. So I split across the humanities, the arts and the sciences. And I was fortunate enough to completely fail my A-levels and not head off to Bristol to study law and have a really proper good rethink. Could you imagine? I'd be just horrible. And I had a really good rethink about what I wanted to do. And a friend of mine who'd got to university of the year that he was supposed to have got to university went up to Bradford to study environmental science. And I'd never heard of environmental science. So I looked at it and thought, wow, this is interesting. This ties into a lot of my passions. I'd been a member of Greenpeace since I was nine, I think. So since about 1977. The height of punk, I joined Greenpeace. It kind of unified my love of the arts and the sciences, being able to go to a university degree and study urban planning and the way people moved around the city, but also to understand the climate change, the SOx and the NOx implications of that. And I really enjoyed the combination of art and science. And for many, many millennia, and certainly for millennia, they were the same thing. It's only more recently that we've separated them out and we talk in quite false ways of, you know, left or right brain. Are you an artist or a scientist? But no one ever told Leonardo da Vinci to stop sketching and crack on with his inventing. And they were the same thing. And I've always felt incredibly passionate about unifying them again. And I was able to do that on my degree. And then I chose a placement degree. Because I wanted to spend that year doing something that I thought would teach me as much as the degree. I was really lucky. I applied for loads of placements. I could have been in British Gas in South London. I don't know what I'd have been doing. I could have been working at Loose Hill Hall Activity Centre, running outward bound activities, wearing tight leggings with one leg up on a rock, looking into the distance.
Very good.
I think I could have rocked that, actually. But thankfully, I didn't get any of those jobs. And then a cracking placement in Camden came up, working with an amazing man who ran a company called TEST, which was Transport and Environment Studies. So it was a very small consultancy. We very powerful, advised people like Transport 2000, the Cyclist Touring Club, who are now called Cycling UK, advised the Labour Party. John Prescott was a regular visitor. And I was trusted. There's a big leadership lesson here. My boss really trusted me. So I redesigned the streets of Clerkenwell, putting the traffic calming in, looking, first of all, and there's a really interesting design method here. I spent time watching how traffic flowed. I spent time looking, and people tend to think that you would rat run, you would come off the main road and run parallel to the main road in order to come in ahead. But actually, it's much more complex than that. People are cutting across. So I sat and watched the way that traffic moved, and then I talked to people about where their challenges were. We did crazy stuff, which isn't that crazy in retrospect, but looking at the crossing angle, how are people crossing the road at 90 degrees? That's an indication that the road is dangerous. If they're crossing it at around about 240 degrees, then they're ambling across and the road feels safe. So we did loads of work around safety. We pedestrianized Brigger in Leeds. That was a really interesting piece of work that I did. And I learned to understand how cities and people flow. And I'm the whole kind of psychogeography, actually, of cities, I find utterly fascinating. Yeah, yeah. And from there, and I also learned about how to run a small business. My parents ran small businesses all the way through my upbringing. But working with this guy, John Roberts, was great. I genuinely could see the benefit of being in a company that cared. And so I'd met my wife a couple of years before. We went to the same school, but during that year, we kind of got jiggy with it. We got it on. But I had to go back to Bradford to finish my degree. And so Nicola and I got married at the beginning of my final year. We left London, but the plan was always to come back and work for John. Sadly, he died 3 months later. We got married and I finished my degree. And we ended up being up in Yorkshire. I got a job in London, but Nicola didn't, vice versa. And then yeah. I had a really big break. I got a job with a local authority doing environmental auditing. This was 93 of small businesses in Yorkshire. So I spent 4 years in carpet factories, in plastic widget making, in engineering, and people who made circlips and screws. And I'd visit 60 factories a year. And that was just utterly the best apprenticeship anyone can have in sustainability. And yeah, I learned loads about manufacturing, loads about the science. I mean, I got a degree in environmental science at this point anyway. And I was really fortunate enough to be able to persuade quite stuck in their ways people that they needed to do something different in terms of sustainability. And what I found is those powers of persuasion were actually around creative thinking and innovation. They were not actually to do with sustainability, because if you shout at people, they just listen less hard. So yeah, yeah. I realized that my skills were actually in persuasion and innovation. And that was really fortunate. I then left there. And I went to Asda as head of sustainability for Asda, thinking, you know, maybe I could turn a big company around. That's hard work, and so it proved. And you know those moments where you realize culturally you're in a real clash with the place that you're in. Yeah. That's what happened to me. You know, when I hadn't seen my children awake for a year, apart from at the weekends, I went, yeah, this isn't right. Lovely people. Just not for me. So I left and started my own business. And I've been doing that now, Sean, for 20 years, 21 years. Wow. Running my own business. Sustainability, innovation, a little bit of authoring and some public speaking. And that's how we met.
Exactly. And so, I mean, on that, so go on then, in terms of, obviously there'd be quite a lot of things that one really sort of can't talk about in terms of client confidentiality, but perhaps in terms of a couple of case histories that you can talk about, go on then, perhaps just take us through a couple of things that you've worked on that you really enjoyed and found suitably inspiring and insightful, etc.
Of course, yeah. So for 10 years, I specialised in sustainable design, and that was anything from packaging. So I worked a lot on packaging to reduce complexity, reduce composite materials so that things were much more easy to recycle or disassemble, or in some cases, removing packaging. And then, of course, Sean, realizing that in some cases, packaging reduces environmental impact. So the biggest embodied impact of a product is in the product. And if you damage it, then that has a bigger carbon impact than the actual packaging itself. A good example there is the cucumber, which most definitely is one of the only vegetables that you should wrap in plastic, but you definitely should. And that feels counterintuitive, but it's true. Apples, don't ever put plastic near them, right? So, and mushrooms equally. So I spent a lot of time digging into that for big brands, look, the supermarkets that you'd expect me to work for.
Yeah.
I also worked with Belkin, who are the computer peripherals company, just reducing box size and taking away unnecessary layers of plastic within packaging, replacing it with die-cut folded card. And that was brilliant. We saved, I don't know, I think we saved Belkin. These are all case studies that I can talk about. I think we saved Belkin 3.6 million quid a year through the work that we did with them. But most importantly, Sean, if you reduce the box size by about 80%, which is what we did, that means you can get four more boxes on the shelf and take the same footprint. Now, they were selling out a product in some shops by midday because they didn't have enough stock on the shelf. Well, you can now get four times the stock on the shelf. So they weren't selling out every day. So they only needed to deliver every 2 days. So number one, they made more money because there was product to buy. And number two, the distribution impacts were significantly reduced because you were only having to deliver every other day. So I began to have this ability to look at the whole picture rather than just say, oh, what's the material? What's the size? Actually, what's the knock-on impact? I did some work with Dorset Cereals to remove the film behind the window that they punched into the cardboard, which made the outer pack unrecyclable. And that's a great piece of work, and there was loads of consumer benefit to that. But most importantly, it meant they could make twice as many packs in the same amount of time. And so I got very good at that kind of thing. We worked with Hotpoint, as they were then, Indesit, as they are now, on their washing machine design. So looking at what breaks, washing machines on the whole, they should last about 7 or 8 years. They could probably last for 10 if you looked after them. But some of these were breaking within a year. So I just did that. It's an eco design of a washing machine. What do? You start with where things break. So talking to kind of engineers about, and they weren't easy to engage with, right? So the way I engaged with them was I stood on the machine, gave them a talk from the machine, jumped off and started taking it apart. And they started to get into that. And I said, what breaks first? What is it that breaks first? And they're like, it's usually the master control board. Okay, how does it break? It gets wet. Right, where is it on the machine? It's just under the water inlet valve.
Yeah.
Right, so shall we move it? Genius. No, that's not genius. That's just the application of common sense.
Yeah.
So I saved there. I can't remember that. There was massive savings for them. Like 4 million, I think. And these are all per year savings. And then other stuff that I did at that point included redesigning homes. So I worked with an amazingly innovative social housing company called Gen 2 up in Sunderland. Utterly breathtakingly market leading, and we redesigned the homes so that people stayed in them longer. So people tend to move from a home because it's not big enough for them, and when they move, neighborhoods begin to change because you don't necessarily know who your neighbor is or who should be in your street, should be in inverted commas. So if we can help people stay there longer, then there's a big carbon impact in not having to build a new home, but also there's a community cohesion impact. So we put things like, we took the W trusses out of, roof trusses out of the roof, and we put attic trusses in, which allowed you to move upstairs for around about a quarter of the price of a normal attic conversion. And that cost £800 more. So we had to then find £800 worth of savings, and we did some simple stuff like taking letterboxes out of front doors and putting boxes on the outside of the door. Now that saved about £300 because of the time it took to make them. But most importantly, you're then removing a draft, so there is a carbon benefit to that as well. And we talked it's really simple, really interesting stuff. We put the foundations, for the home in, we put the foundations for an extension in, and that cost £200 extra. That's all.
Wow.
And then that saves £2,000 when you want to extend your home. So we kind of rethought the home as a series of module ways of living. And we did that. God, that was ages ago, about 2000 and I don't know, maybe 2011, something 10 years ago now. Yeah. So that was exciting. And I've done work with companies that aren't necessarily easy to like, or that people wouldn't associate with good. One of my clients is Coca-Cola, and I know a lot of people don't like them. But I've got this ethos. It's there. It's not easy sometimes to move slowly with big organizations. But I've got this ethos that if you're going to change something, standing outside shouting at them isn't always the answer. It is sometimes. It isn't always the answer. So I'd much rather sit inside and begin to show them another view. And that's paying dividends. So some of that work is really taken off. And and then on the other side of things, like, you know, I work with Patagonia, work with Nike to do kind of more inspiring presentations about where their future could be. And that's gone down really well. So that's a broad collection of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Very nice. And then in terms of the sort of inspiring talks, etc., so the Do Lectures, which have always had a really sort of intriguing aura around them. I mean, you were one of the people that set the Do Lectures up. So Patrick, just talk us through that. So so what the aim was and how that's gone and how the sort of Do Lectures have developed and where they are now, etc.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's a great story. And, you know, I need to be incredibly humble and modest about this. The Do Lectures were established by David Hyatt and Claire Hyatt. And over the next 3 years, they pulled in people to support them, either you know, emotionally, I almost said then, either intellectually or financially. And of those, there were, I think there were four or five people. I was the last one to be asked to put a bit of money in and to put a bit of time in. But I was involved at the beginning as I ran workshop at the sort of second Do Lectures, I think. And I've been to every one, bar one, that I was ill for. And it's an incredibly rewarding organization and an incredibly inspiring event. The aim of Do, as I see it, and we're all different, is this way of bringing ideas and energy together in order to create change. And the way that David and Claire envisaged that and saw that was by bringing the world's most inspiring stories into a room. Now, they're not necessarily the world's most known stories. What David and Claire are very, very good at is getting speakers before they're massive. So bringing Tim Ferriss in before he was massive was amazing. Bringing Ryan Holiday in before he was massive was brilliant. But then they'll find, you know, they'll find the woman that created the farmers market movement in Cardigan, and she's incredibly inspiring. And my role there is diminished over time as they've got bigger and stronger and need less support. And essentially now I turn up at the event and I compare it and I shout from the sidelines. Over the 10 years, I've been much more deeply involved in that. And it's really good to see it booming. It's doing incredibly well. It's still one of the most inspiring events I've ever attended. And I do the bit. I stand up with the microphone and introduce people. I'm normally the one that introduces the bands at night, or the comedian, or yeah. I think it's because I'm the one that's least drunk at that point, actually. I suspect that's what that's about. And I run workshops, and I've written a couple of books for them. They're an amazing bunch of people doing really great things, and they've changed that world, you know. They've changed that world forever.
Yeah. Really, really dynamic. Okay, then. So you mentioned, and also that on the writing side, so Do Disrupt and Do Present. Go on then.
Okay, so Do Disrupt's about 10 years old now. I keep forgetting I've written it. So obviously, over 10 years, that word has become misused, and I probably wouldn't call it that now. But at the time, it felt right. So Do Disrupt was about one of two things, and you can read it in two ways. Coming up with a disruptive business idea, understanding the purpose that sits behind that, and then working it through. It's a process. It's a workbook to take you from idea to testing. Long before sprint theory was a thing, it was sprint theory. Yeah. Or it's a way of disrupting yourself. You know, what is it you want to do? You may be in a job that you particularly don't like, or you don't think is for you. Maybe you've been very successful at it, but it's not where your heart is. Working out what you want to do and being able to gravitate, pivot, change, whatever the word is, towards that. Reorientate yourself towards a different sun, right? So Do Disrupt gives the process and the tools to be able to do that. It's been really good. You know, it's been good to me. I still get messages, direct messages, maybe three or four a week from people who've read it for the first time or picked it up again after two or three years and said that, thank you for this. It was really good. I really enjoyed it. And it makes me nervous when I see anyone's bought it, because I obviously want it to be useful. People have given money for it, and I want to make sure that they get value out of that. So publishing something is very nerve-wracking, in my humble opinion. And when we published that, it was interesting. It was the first batch of Do books, and I thought everyone was doing like a workbook, and they all wrote proper books with like lots of words, whereas I wrote a kind of coloring book, and I was like, excellent. Oh shit. Did I not get the brief? And they said, no, we love it. It's exactly what we want. So the Do Book Company is a separate thing from the Do Lectures. And Miranda, who runs the Do Book Company, is a brilliant editor. I've never worked with anybody as thorough and as amazing as her when it comes to editing. She's very strong. So she was, she helped kick it into shape beautifully. Nice. Do Present is a slightly different thing. So Do Present came about because I ran a presentation. I'm quite good at presenting, and people then ask you to help them with their presenting. So I ran a presentation skills workshop, which is not about, I'll tell you what it's not about, Sean. It's not about how many slides to use, how many words per slide. It's not about any of that stuff. It's really about unpeeling the onion that is you, to find out who you are at your core, and then giving you the skills and the confidence to amplify that into a message that you can share. So it's truly about how you find your voice. I wanted to call it Do Voice, but we've got one called Do Sing, and there was a fear that they might overlap in their understanding. So we called it Do Present, and It takes you from working out who you are, what you stand for, and it takes you all the way through to how you stand on the stage, and most importantly then how you take yourself off the stage. And it's very much focused on understanding your constraining beliefs, your belief systems, and breaking those down and understanding what sits behind your the barriers that you place in front of yourself. Now, some people have their voice stolen by their own fear. Some people have their voice stolen by a well-meaning parent who maybe speaks for you, or maybe is fearful of your eccentricities and just asks you to be quiet. And we had one person on the workshop once who, second generation Indian family in the UK, and his mum, who was first generation, said to him, you know, stay small, keep your voice quiet, don't be seen, and you'll avoid trouble. Because back in the 70s, that was the right way of doing things in her mind.
Sure, yeah.
And actually that hasn't served them well as they've grown, because small is where they gravitate to. So there can be many reasons why people stay small, but, you know, you stay small to keep safe, but then you're trapped in small. So a good part of the book and the workshops are about helping you fit into a bigger pot so your roots can grow and your voice can grow in proportion.
Mm, nice. But you're saying that came out with appalling timing, just as the as the pandemic hit. So, but it's out there now, and It's done all right.
I very quickly wrote another chapter called "When Zoom Is the Room," and you get a code to download that when you buy the book, and that talks about being able to be human in an inhuman platform, and that's if it's reprinted, then that chapter will find its way in.
Nice, very good. So, in terms of the issues that are really concerning you at the moment, I mean, to state the staggeringly obvious, the existential issue that impacts all of us that you've been sort of very much focusing on for, you know, since time began in many ways from the point of view of all things environmental and ecological, etc. I mean, obviously, only a sort of a fairly short time ago now, although it seems 1,000 years ago, COP26. I mean, when one is looking at things like COP26 and what the thinking was going into it and what the realities were in terms of the activity and actions taken as a result, when you've also got things like, you know, Extinction Rebellion and what's been happening to them over the last couple of years, and the debates and the sort of the noise around those, like sort of Greta Thunberg. I mean, where are you on this whole situation now? I mean, I know it's just like a vast question, but perhaps starting with COP26, I mean, what's your view now as the sort of dust settles on that? Success, failure, something in between, something else, or what?
Yeah, I'd say so. I was up at COP26, and I would say it was something in between. You know, it's really easy to be frustrated with two things. One, the fact that people only just get it, but as Dave said at the sang at the Brits, if you don't want to get it, then you're never going to get it. And suddenly people want to get and understand sustainability. And those of us that have been banging on about it for years are like, thank God, but it's too late. And I think that's probably true. I think it is probably too late. So moving into COP26, expectations were really high because public awareness had risen significantly. Yeah. And, I went up and sat and stood on a stand and gave three talks, and I found it in equal measure utterly uplifting and utterly depressing. The uplifting part, everyone agrees there's a problem. We're all headed in the same direction at different speeds, but no one is in denial. At COP25, there were still people saying, well, this could be sunspots. This might not be to do with climate change. This could be something else. Like, blown out of the water. All of that's gone. And there's now a real focus. I was up there with a regenerative agriculture project. That's those words are difficult and not always widely liked. But I think people know what I mean when I say that. If we repair the soils, if we can get to, you know, 4 parts per million in the soil, we can begin to reverse climate change over the next 10 years. It will be that quick, that demonstrable. And we can grow better, greater, and more diverse food as well. But the profits shift, the money shifts. It's going to cost us more money as customers or consumers. So number one, we're all looking in the right direction. Everyone wants to go together. We do want to travel at different speeds. There's some people there in a Tesla on ludicrous mode, and there's some people there in a Citroen 2CV. They're both eco cars in the eyes of many, eyes of some, but they're traveling at very different speeds. So the frustration is now one of attrition between moving fast and moving slow. So I'll take that, right? I'll celebrate and welcome that. Then the frustration is, oh my God, can they not see that burning fossil fuels is the problem? And you look at the final agreement that was watered down, and it's heartbreaking. I know that, and it feels like a failure. But then I have to flip back to the fact that it would never have happened 2 years ago. It would never have happened at COP25. So I oscillate between those two views of it was brilliant, we got loads agreed to, but we didn't get enough agreed. And I sit somewhere between the horns of that dilemma. My frustration being up there was it became a kind of eco Disney. Lots of people having their photograph taken underneath a swinging globe saying, you know, up at COP26 because you've got to do your bit, # sustainability. Like that, it became a kind of form of branding or a form of marketing that felt a little bit disingenuous. Plus the fact that sometimes science goes out of the window. The amount of conversations I've had over meals and dinners with people, and they're really obsessed with plastic in the oceans, and it's a problem. It is a massive problem that we need to solve. And I'm sat there watching them eat fish, and you have that conversation that goes, what are the three biggest challenges to the oceans? And they always say the same thing, plastic. I said, no, you're right. It's within the third biggest challenge category. What's the biggest challenge to the oceans? And they don't know. And it's climate change. Climate change is, and this is why we become myopic on carbon. And I understand how frustrating that is, but I also understand why that is. Carbon is, like, climate change is the single biggest challenge that we face, bar none. Nothing is going to come close to it. We have to do something. And so climate change is a logarithmic factor of 10 greater than anything else. Then the second biggest challenge to the oceans, as I'm certain you're aware, is overfishing. And overfishing is colossally damaging. And Hugh Fearnley dealt with this with his bycatch TV show 12 years ago, 10 years ago. And yet I'm sat talking to someone who's bemoaning, criticizing large corporations that use plastic film on their chocolate wrapping whilst they're eating something that is causing more damage. And it's hard to have that conversation when the visibility of the plastic in the ocean is so great. And then the third biggest challenge to the oceans is ocean debris. And ocean debris is a very broad category. And the single biggest element of ocean debris, the single most damaging element of ocean debris, is agricultural runoff. And the whole way that we treat, not just dung and piss is important, but antibiotics, the damage that comes off the farms into the oceans. And then it's things like plastic, which needs, I'm not saying we should use more of the stuff. I'm saying, actually, it's really important to understand the hierarchy and to take action across all of those areas rather than demonize one thing. We need to, climate change is just staggeringly scary, and how what we eat can go a long way to solving these problems.
I mean, it's interesting that you use the term demonize there, because it does, to state the stunningly obvious, seem that a lot of this is about finger pointing and blame and anger, in many cases, obviously, as it quite naturally and obviously should be. But on the other side, in terms of giving people inspiring examples of actually this is how to do it, here are some people or services or, dare I say it, products or approaches that actually do work. Who are the sort of people or the organizations or indeed the brands that you point to and think, you know what, there is a setup that actually is doing it really, really well?
Oh, that's a great question and properly putting me on the spot, but I like it. I like it. Just to go back to the first part of that question, which I think is very important, there is this finger pointing challenge that we have, this demonizing, and it's, you know, the term I use is the biggest challenge we have in the environmental world is friendly fire. So we all want to do the same thing, but our agendas are slightly different. And so we're seeing the environmental movement almost attack itself. Now, without wanting to sound like a conspiracy theorist, because I'm genuinely not, that's what people want. What the big players want. They want us to disagree over what the problem is so they can carry on whilst we fight amongst ourselves. There needs to be unity here, no matter whether you're pro-animals and regenerative agriculture or anti-animals and pro-vegan, or whether you're anti-plastic and pro-glass, even though that's going to increase climate change, or whether you're anti-glass and pro-plastic and that's going to increase marine debris. We need to come together, and we're not. And that is the single biggest risk here. The second part of your question was brilliant. Now, it was you know, who should we look at? Who's doing good stuff? Well, even those companies that aren't easy to like are doing something. So 10 years ago, they were doing nothing. Right now, everyone is trying to do something. So firstly, embrace the good stuff. Secondly, beware of what my friend Claire Potter calls, another Brighton resident actually, Sean, calls green cocking. So this combination of greenwashing and peacocking. So you pick the thing, it's great, isn't it? It's a lovely portmanteau. You pick the thing that you know you're doing well and shout about that, ignoring the things that actually you're not doing so well at. And it becomes, and that's what I saw up at COP26, you know, taking one for the planet, because, well, hey, you've got to. Yes, but how did you get here? What do you eat? How do you, what are you buying? What's your consumption? It's very easy to focus on the wrong thing and to shout about that. But so there's no business. I don't know one business at the moment that is doing nothing on this. That's the first time I've ever been able to say that, Sean. I know lots of businesses that aren't doing enough, and I'm not going to disagree with anybody on that. Yeah. And, when we look at leaders in this, they may come from surprising places. So you'd expect me to talk about Patagonia, and they're a client, and I will, because they're amazing and they do great things. But, we can't all be Patagonia. We look more closer to home. You've got Finisterre down in Cornwall, doing really good things with wool. So they're using the British equivalent of merino, which is a wool called Beaumont wool, and they're using that in their products, and they're doing that beautifully. And they're not just making products with less impact, they're definitely doing that. They're also helping grow a rural economy as well. And then the investigation that they've done on wetsuits, because they're a cold water surfing company above and beyond anything else. Yeah. So how do we reduce the environmental impact on neoprene? The money that they've spent on developing new looks, I think it's called new looks, alternatives to neoprene is amazing. And that's shared. And then you've got brands who I wouldn't wear, but I really value them, like Allbirds, who've come up. I'm not interested in the upper, the way I look at a shoe is it needs to last. And that is that having something that lasts a long time is more important than having something that's knitted. But I understand that for some, that's the way forward. And shoes are really interesting. If you were to look at the an Adidas or a Nike product versus I never know how to pronounce it, Vega leather shoe, the Adidas and Nike or Under Armour, whoever it is, the carbon impact of their product is around about half of that of the Vega or Veja product. Yeah, but people like the V, that they're a good company, they've got good ethics, and consequently, it's really easy to confuse real impact with perception. And that's all to do with weight, Sean. There's nothing fundamentally bad about the product. It's weight and the fact that it's made of an animal. So I would look, even more closer to home. There's some really interesting food brand startups. What Proper Corn are doing is really good. They're a relatively low impact manufacturer. All Plants are doing really good work here as well. And then you've got some beautiful companies in the meat industry who are selling hunted produce, hunted meat with less impact, and it's not crazy expensive. And then I would look at people like, Adidas and Nike are really good examples. Investing in Flyknit technology reduces the weight of the shoe, so therefore its environmental footprint, and it has no waste because it's knitted to size, whereas everything else is cut to size. So what you have in your hand has a long tail. And that long tail is the manufacturing process. So being able to look at that as part of it, I'm lucky. I get to have a telescope to do that. Other people just judge it on the product, and why wouldn't you? That's in your hand. I get that. So there's some really interesting stuff. But the most uplifting thing for me is every single one of the briefs I get has this in it now. And that wasn't the case. So who's moving fast? And the fact that everyone's moving, they're both really exciting developments that have changed over the last 5 years. And there are reasons to be cheerful here. The biggest selling car back end of last year was an electric vehicle. Whether or not, there's a lot of bunkum spoken about, the life cycle of electric vehicles is negative because of the embedded resources. No, it's really clear. Over a standard driving range, 10,000 miles a year, the life cycle of electric vehicles is less than that of a diesel or petrol vehicle. For a long time, we were confused about that. There is no confusion now. You've got a probe being sent down by the Eden Centre, 5 kilometres down into the ground, to find superheated water, bring it up, and look at using that to power turbines to generate electricity. And they're bringing water up at about 4.5 kilometers down. They're bringing water up at around about 150 degrees C, superheated water. They think that they can power the world on geothermal, deep geothermal energy. And you know what? I believe them. That gives me massive hope. The investment in regenerative agriculture, excuse the terminology, by literally every business in the food industry, that gives me huge, huge hope. So I have reason to be cheerful, as well as a mild frustration that we're not all moving. No, a big frustration. We're not all moving fast enough. So my gut instinct is, you know, what we've always said, can you buy what you need to buy from the producer? Can you get as close to the producer as you can? Number one, it'll be cheaper. Number two, you can find out more about it. Can you reduce what you buy? Can you buy less? And that's how, you know, the industry has the challenge of how is it going to make the same money by selling less stuff? And some of the work that I do on circular economy business models is concerned exactly with that. The superheroes aren't always wearing capes, and they can weirdly be wearing suits. And that feels uncomfortable to say that. I appreciate.
Very nice indeed. Superheroes don't wear capes. As we begin to get to the end of this, and it's been absolutely great talking with you, Mark. Okay, you mentioned just a while ago about sort of reasons to be cheerful. So where do you find your, cheerful inspiration from?
Well, there are hundreds of people. There's a great piece of artwork by the amazing author, artist Chris Jordan, who brought plastic pollution to our attention in the first place, actually, with phenomenal photographs of dead seabirds with their bellies full of cullet or paper, plastic pellet. He's got this great drawing, picture of a, it's a circle, and it's made up of names of all of the environmental bodies in America. And at first, they all look like they were on their own. There's a few names, and then the next drawing's a bit further back and a bit further back, until there is a circle that is four times the size of a human, filled with the names of all the people doing great things, all the organizations doing great things. And it's really easy to think that we are alone fighting this. The key thing we have to do is reach out to one another. That friendly fire conversation is a really good example. We need a weird alliance of those people who are headed in the same direction. So I look for people doing good things, and they can be in very dark places sometimes. They can be in large organizations, but they are doing amazing stuff. And then I look for people who are doing good things in the community. The watch out is those people who say they're doing good things, but actually it's just brilliant marketing. And that whole marketing revolution, you know, the end of lying, the end of hiding, the end of control. I add to that, the fourth one I add is, I spot in a book by Mark Schaefer. It's a very good book called Marketing Rebellion. I add to that the end of romancing. So this, you know, talking so much about one, it's not quite lying, but it is that overemphasizing the good things that you do and ignoring the real impact of what you do. So that's a watch out, you know, and the Green Claims Code, the government's Green Claims Code has just been changed, and you now can't make green claims without scientific evidence. And this, it's literally like days old. This will change the way that we talk about things and understanding the environmental impact of what we do. So look for the lights. There are loads of them, and you see them best when the world is at its darkest. Pull them together. Work together.
Yeah, very nice indeed. Okay, then, Mark, so in that case, perhaps the last sort of couple of questions, just to perhaps give us a Blairite sort of a soundbite. But so in terms of sort of key takeaway points that people should be considering when they're looking at this overall subject, and perhaps for clients that hopefully may be listening in and would like to talk with you, go on then, just to remind us in brief about exactly the sort of things that you can be doing for organizations, big or small.
Well, first off, most people don't need me. They can do it on their own. And that seems like a lunacy for me to say that, but it's true. Look at where you are. Look at your biggest environmental impact. Be scientific about it. Science is a secret weapon in all of this. Emotions are really important, but science is a secret weapon. And I'll give you an example here. So the David Attenborough documentary that revealed the impact on the oceans of ocean debris was really dramatic and incredibly successful. Yeah. That episode is split into two halves. The second half is about the ocean and plastic. What was the first half about? Yeah, no one knows. No one knows because it's climate change. It was all about climate change. Now, the thing is, with the second half, you can blame somebody else. With climate change, you have to take some blame yourself. You have to start with where you are. So you need to understand your biggest environmental impact. Obviously, I can help people do that, but they don't necessarily need me to do that. Then put a metric on it so you can see where you are. Boring, but true. Then tell your story and be honest. You know, that those three marketing revolutions, the end of lying, the end of hiding, and the end of control. You are not what you say you are anymore. You are what we say you are. And if someone will find out. So you have to have incredibly porous walls to your business and to be able to have proper conversations with your customers and your suppliers about what you do. And stop hiding. It's not feasible to do that anymore. And there are really great examples, really amazing people doing things. Learn from them. And there's some good stuff. You know, when all birds produced their soul that was made out of sugarcane, they let the intellectual property rights, they shared it with everyone. It was actually really hard to get that off them, as I found out. But they did share that with everyone. So how can we all be lifted on a rising tide? What can we share? How can we move forward together? And that kind of co-creation really fires me up massively.
Very good indeed. Well, look, Mark, it's been absolutely fantastic. So just to everyone, it's entirely clear about where they can actually track you down. So go on then, just remind us all.
Okay, so you can get me on my website, which is www.thisisape.co.uk. I have a side project called Reasons to be Cheerful, which is a diverse publishing house, which is www.reasonstobecheerful.co.uk. Social media, you'll find me on Instagram at Mark Shaler. And then weirdly at Twitter, I'm at Green Ape. It was the days when Twitter started and you all had a nom de plume. You all everyone had a name that wasn't quite, I think you were Captain Crikey, or you are Captain Crikey.
Oh, there you were back in the day.
We all had a name that wasn't ours. And consequently, I've missed that on Mark Shaler. So I'm at Green Ape on there. And you'll find me on LinkedIn and you'll find me on Medium and YouTube. YouTube's a good place to go. There's loads of videos that I've done there about some of these really important issues.
Very good. Well, Mark, it's been absolutely fantastic talking with you. So what can I say apart from to the thinker, doer, creator, speaker and author, Mark Shaler, thank you very much indeed.
And thank you, Sean. You know, I think a big word of thanks to you, because you have an ability to see a little further than most. And that's allowed you to develop this series of podcasts. But we've worked together and you bring real, what's the word? You bring a giraffe-like neck to a situation where they don't normally exist. So thank you for that.
That's very, very kind of you. I have to say, by the way, in terms of sort of working together, always been brilliant, and have to give a massive shout out to the mighty Helen, my partner, who runs the whole organisation alongside me. So very much a team effort.
I think both our other halves make everything better and are really the true bosses of what we do.
Very much so. It has to be said, a massive shout out to the Mikey, Nick Shaler. Totally. Well, look, fantastic stuff. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.